Noble.
KB4CBA, W4DJW. I was just thinking about you.
I saw it.
Well, I was trying to do the math when you got your license and when we were pumping gas at Hess. How many years had it been between there? And in that period of time, what got you to get your license, your ham radio license?
Thank Phil, W4NGU, Never Give Up, or North Greenville University, for getting me into the hobby. And the main thing that caught my interest was at the time, and you got to remember, we didn't know what a cell phone was the fact that you could make phone calls from your car.
So we were pumping gas in the late 70s, right?
I think I started my senior year the summer after I graduated, you know, and then I went to North Greenville, and then I came home and basically just decided, you know, college wasn't for me. And so, I think I went to work for Roscoe Supply. I don't know, that didn't sound right. I really don't remember what I did. But I didn't work for Hess for a while, and then I went to Mars Hill, went back to school, and when I would come home on the weekend, I would drive in, straight in to the Hess station and not even go home, and ask Mr. Martin if he needed any help this weekend. And he'd, you know, the guys would be sitting there, and he'd say, "You guys want off?" Well, you know, it never fails. Somebody would jump up and go, "Yeah." And so I would work from then until close, till 11, and then I would work 16 hours on Saturday, and he would slip me a $50 bill under the table. And that was a lot of money back in 1977, 75, 76, 77.
W4DJW. Yeah, that'd buy a new CB radio. And we were all running CB radios back then, I think. I don't know how long that lasted. That might have been just a couple of years that those lasted. But, so you and Brian Wilson, whose father's name was Ken Wilson, who Brian went to high school too at the same time I did, so he graduated he and I were entering Eastside when you were exiting Eastside, so there wasn't any overlap there. But another guy I went to school with, Bucky Youngblood, was working at Hess with me, and it seems like we would come up there to work when you were leaving. There was just a little bit of overlap, but then sometimes if we didn't want to work, you'd work for us, or I guess that's where that came in, because I was working like three jobs at the time and going to school. So there's sometimes I would just rather leave and not work that shift, and you probably replaced me on a few of those. But I was just wondering what stimulated you to do that, because my dad was a ham radio licensed, Brian's dad was a ham radio licensed operator, and we never got into it until many, many years later. And you got into it probably less than 10 years later?
83, and I graduated high school in 73, so, you know, it was 10 years after high school. And I was working at the Daniel Building, well, what was called the Daniel Building back then, and I was having a job in an office on the 19th floor, three-piece suit and a briefcase. I thought I'd made it. And and anyway, I look back on that and just laugh. But Phil started kind of nudging me a little bit. And, you know, I got to seeing what it was all about. And I've always been interested in talking on, you know, two-way communications. I used to mess around with walkie-talkies when I was a kid, and and even older. And so, you know, it was, to me, that was just neat.
Well, Brian got into it because, well, I don't know. His dad was a ham radio operator, and he was the radio dispatch guy at the, those guys that go out catching the guys that poach at nighttime. What are those? Wildlife officer? I can't remember their names. But anyway, he was in radio. He'd have me go over there to that station they had by the lake over by 85. And sit and talk to him while he was dispatching, because he'd get bored sitting there for hours by himself. But I guess that, plus his dad being a ham radio operator, got him into it. What got me into it was flying RC planes and really wanting to know how that controller, the transmitter that you hold in your hand, was making that airplane control surfaces move so precisely and so smoothly as they were. That's... I always wanted to because of that, but then finally did because I was sitting on a bridge on 85 for a couple of hours waiting for a backup, listening to my scanner that I normally used to listen to CB, but found the ham radio button on it and punched it, and voila, up came a couple of guys on probably this repeater. But anyway, I was just wondering, what do you know what got Phil into it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting there when you look back, because I know Phil lived right behind me, almost directly behind me. He's kind of diagonally behind me in Wellington Green, and I remember him and Art Cole would get together a lot, and they were messing around with ham radio and. But I don't know, at that time I was more interested in CB for, you know, and for whatever reason, and my dad took me, he took me to Radio Shack up there. There was one on 291 right there below Bob Jones, and we went in. He was going to buy me a base station. I couldn't believe it because my dad, he never bought me anything. But he saw how interested I was, and because I built a shortwave radio receiver and from a kid. And so we walked in the Radio Shack, and I showed him the unit I wanted, and he said, "We want to get that," and the guy wouldn't sell it to him. He said, "We're trying to keep, you know, the public off the CB because the business people want to use it for, you know, business usage, and they don't want, you know, just regular people on there. They don't want to use it for business purposes." Man, I could have choked that guy.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a strategy that would fly in today's market. I don't know if they did any good after that. Well, Radio Shack, probably not. Or they're all but out of business, I guess. Anyway, that's what I was thinking about, and I thought, I wonder if he's on the air. I should just key up and ask him, because my workday's winding down. And I unmuted the speaker, and I went and hunted for the window that's got the transmit button in it and found it, and you threw your call out there at the same time. What are the chances? W4DJW.
4CPA. Well, the way it goes sometimes. I forget what I was going to tell you. So anyway, I left, I guess, the most disappointed I've ever been, and really upset at that salesman. You know, if I'd have been older, I'd say, "Well, I want to see the manager, and I want to be sure and tell him that you don't want the store to make any money today by selling the radio to me." Because I mean, they weren't super expensive, but they weren't cheap, And like I said, I was flabbergasted that my dad was going to buy one for me. But anyway, now that I'm retired and we're for the first time in my entire life debt free, I got the radio that I really wanted, and I doubt I'll ever buy another one for HF because I just love that 7300.
You'll buy another one. You know you will. That's part of the hobby, is getting new toys or build another one. That's what my dad did for me, is he bought me kits, receiver kits that I put together. And those were a lot of fun. I got to use the soldering gun. That was like 10 years before I graduated high school is when all that started. But that was really fun. And even before that, building crystal radio sets with him, and using his old Army headset to listen on the crystal radio, because he was a radio man in the Army. I was trying to figure out where I met Steve, because we were like coming in to Eastside when you guys were leaving. I think I met Steve out on the airfield at WCRC and went over to his house and bought an airplane from him. I think that's how we met. But, or it could have been being over there in, I don't know if it was Wellington Green or not. I don't remember what neighborhood he grew up in. It might have been the same one that you and Phil grew up in. But I was over there a lot, too, with another buddy of mine, the one that he was talking about that got thrown in prison. He liked to fight a lot. And it wound him up in prison, Barry.
I have some fond memories of those days, and some that aren't so great, but that's the way it goes. Probably, knowing what I know now, I probably would have done some things a little different, but, what the heck. I usually say I was young and stupid. Now I'm old and stupid, so I just know a little bit more. But yeah, I made a crystal radio. I remember that. It fascinated me, that little thing could receive a radio station. I was flabbergasted by that thing. It was just amazing.
W4DJW. The cool part to me was that it could do it without a battery or without plugging it in. Well, what made that thing work? I had a hard time believing radio waves were strong enough to actually power that thing and make those speakers put the audio out that it did. And it put out really good audio, too, at least what I thought was good audio. I used to listen to the Grand Ole Opry on those things from Tennessee. And they came in good, strong, loud and clear. So did you know Steve when you were in high school, or did you meet him later?
VWA.
Yeah, that's Steve Wilder.
Yeah, we met in high school. I'm not sure where he went to junior high. But I know we were at Eastside together, because we played in a band together. He might have been in Northwood too, but I just can't remember. But we called him the Wild Man back then. He lived up to his name, his last name, boy, I tell you. And he had all the toys. He had a little Honda 50. Man, I just loved that thing. And he had a dune buggy with just a Volkswagen frame with one of those fiberglass dune buggy kits that you bolt on, and he just had all the toys, and I really envied him. But radio controlled planes have always been real interesting to me, too. I still want to get an RC, and I was really impressed with your controller. It looked like I could tell that you'd put a lot of thought into that and time.
Well, they are a lot of fun, and they've made huge breakthroughs in the last few years with the autopilots. They've been using autopilots for a long time, and then a company out, I think they're in California. They might be a little bit east of California, but they're the ones that, for 3DR is the name of the company, and they came out with the autopilot. And then that's when DJI picked up on it, and it just started exploding. They had an open source autopilot, and that autopilot could keep a multi-rotor stable in the air. Wasn't near as stable as they are now, but it was stable enough to fly. And it was a whole lot easier to fly than an RC airplane, because those planes you have to fly. This one you really didn't have to. You just had to move it around. But they've come a long way. I enjoy those a lot, too. That's my number one hobby that I don't get to do as much, because you have to go somewhere to do it. You can't do it from home. Ham radio will make you lazy. You can sit on your chair at home and do ham radio all day long. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort once you get it all set up.
So I was just dragging my feet there to see if anybody wanted to jump in. I'm sitting in the garage. I got my car back today. My speed sensor went out. And I had a bunch of lights come on the dash. It looked like a Christmas tree. And no speedometer. It was, I don't like it when my car messes up. And I had to pull the code. I couldn't not do it. Being a technician, I had to know what it was. So I knew that, when I took it to George Coleman, and they told me what they said was wrong with it, they weren't yanking my chain. So, and that's what it was. They said it was boogered up, and the transmission had been taken out a couple of years ago by CarMax, and they had put a new clutch and everything in it before I bought it. And evidently they must have boogered it up. And it hung in there for a couple of years and finally gave it up.
Well, I heard you talking about that and wondered if you got that straightened out. I don't know. That's the reason. That's one of the reasons that I don't buy American-made cars anymore. I used to buy nothing but, if I bought a Ford, it was a Mustang. And then everything else was Chevrolet. Maybe GMC or something like that. But I was all the time having car troubles, all the time. It was just constant. And I just couldn't figure it out. Why am I having trouble so much? And then I heard somebody spreading the word that Detroit, whether it's Ford or GM, was designing things to wear out in 60,000 miles. And back then, I could only afford a vehicle that had that many miles on it. So I was getting them right when it was time for them to break down, so I figured that out. So I went to my uncle, because a lot of my family from Michigan, a lot of them worked in the auto industry. So I went to the uncle that I had that was the closest to it, and I asked him, is that for real? Are they doing that? And he said, yeah, they're doing that. That's how they make money. If they don't do that, they can't make money. They can't stay in business. So I tucked that away in my mind for a little while and pondering on it, decided I'm going to try an import. And that's when the imports were really getting good. That's when the Japanese came up with that model. I forget what they used to call it, Demmings model of manufacturing. And they were producing some really good cars. And I started getting those instead of American-made cars. And I could go for years without finding myself on the side of the road needing a tow truck. And haven't looked back. And I made my uncle angry as could be, because he's the one that told me about it, and I abandoned them. And every time he sees one of my cars that's not American-made cars, he just shakes his head. Can't stand it. W4DJW.
I'll tell you this, I worked on cars since on and off since '87, and you wreck recognize quality when you see it, and you recognize junk when you see it, when you work on it. And so, but, you know, I'm impressed with Ford. I mean, now, when I worked on them at the county, you know, we would put timing chains on some of the cars, the older Fords, because we could turn the crankshaft. If you could turn the crankshaft more than 12 degrees and the distributor didn't move, then there was enough play in the timing chain to change it. And when you took the front off the engine there to get the timing chain, sure enough, the crank gear was plastic. So, but when you got a new crank gear, cam gear. When you got a new one, it was all metal. So there you go.
Well, I used to work on them too. That was my job before I decided it's time to go back to school. And it was my part-time job while I was working at Michelin when I decided I was laying in the road underneath a truck on a hill changing out the starter. And it started raining and water started coming down the road. And I was next to the curb and that water was going under my neck and getting me soaking wet. And I'm holding that heavy starter up there and everything's wet, the wrenches and all that. And I'm looking it up there and saying, I can't do this forever. I got to go back to school. And that's when I decided to go back to school. But I worked on them all the time. And that nylon coating on there was for to quieten it down. When you put that all metal one on there, it's substantially louder. So it reduced vibrations and made it quieter, but at the expense of, after it gets a few years on it and some miles, it does start to get brittle and crack. And then they find their way down to the oil pan. And then the oil pan tries to pick them up, and then it gets stuck in the mesh and the gears on the pump. And then you don't get oil to the upper part, and then you find yourself rebuilding the engine. So add pluses and minuses. But those were good old days, but I wouldn't want to go back to them.
For CBA, yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed working for the county. You know, there was no pressure. We just got paid by the hour. And some of the guys would just sit there and do nothing. And the bosses wouldn't say anything. And they'd look at me and say, David, why are you working so hard? They said, it pays the same. Sit here. Someone go to the mall. And your county dollars, your tax dollars at work here now. But anyway, and I'd say, you know, I got to work. Sometimes I would turn double the hours that I actually worked. We worked, I think, 36 hours a week, and I would, or 37 and a half, something like that. Anyway, I would double that in flat rate hours, and I begged them to get a flat rate, and they wouldn't do it.
You know, I knew that flat rate thing existed, but I never did use that. Oh, well, I don't guess I used that. I charged by the, I ran my own shop, and I just charged by whatever the job was. And I really didn't charge near enough either because I got all kinds of, I had more work than I could do, and I wasn't making any money at it. I could change a set of brakes in like a half hour, 45 minutes, all four brakes. And, you know, tune-ups, less than an hour, that kind of stuff, and had tons and tons of work, but just was not charging near enough to make any money. I just was not a businessman at that time.
Out of my driveway, when I lived on Hunts Bridge Road, and I made a pretty good living out of it. And I used the flat rate book, whatever it said, to charge. Usually what I charged them as far as hours, and I charged $40 an hour, but now the dealerships and all were charging $80 and $90 an hour. So I was, you know, a lot cheaper. And I was real fair with people, and I probably, you know, did work a lot cheaper than I should have sometime. But I made some good money, and that's when I bought a lot of my ham radio gear.
I remember pulling engines, stripping them down using air tools. Pull the engine out, strip it down using air tools, and take it to Doc Green's over in Traveler's Rest and give it to Jones in the back. And he would vault it. First time I ever did that, I took him an old greasy block. It was really greasy. And he looked at me and he said, "I'll do this one, but next one you bring to me, you need to clean it up pretty good before you bring it to me." So I did that. I respected that after a while. But he did a fantastic job. He would, he'd line bore it. He'd bore the cylinders. He'd, shave the head. He'd lap the valves. He did everything like that. All I had to do is rip it apart really quick with air tools, give him the parts, get the kit from upstairs, go back, put it all together, torque it all back together, and put it back in. I had a barn that had some beams across the top, and I had a hoist that would pull the engine out. Do the same thing with transmissions, but just couldn't make any money at it. Just did not know what to charge people. W4DJW.
No, I never got into building the bottom end of engines. Honestly, I just never came upon one that needed it. And my line of work, if I was at a dealership, if the engine was that bad, you know, they would just buy. If it was out of warranty, they would just buy a used one out of the junkyard, and we would just swap them out. But I pulled a lot of heads off of cars and had them sent out for have them, you know, planed and have a valve job and all that. And I did a lot of that. But I did anything that came, worked on anything that came in the door, you know, it didn't matter what it was. And so I saw a lot of different cars and a lot of different headaches. But anyway, I'm glad those days are over. That's why I've got a extended warranty on this thing, and I pay $100 and they fix it. So, you know, and if they get it wrong, then I take it back and I don't have to pay a dime. So they get to fix it for free. So, you know, that's the way I like it.
Just leaving a little gap there in case somebody else wanted to come in. Well, that's the way I like it anymore nowadays, too, when I was working on them constantly. And by the way, you were talking about Steve having the dune buggy. That's what I drove up to the Hess station for a while, until I traded it for a Pontiac Firebird. But it Volkswagen with a fiberglass body that bolts onto a shrunk down VW frame. They cut like 14 inches. They cut it in half behind the driver's seat, and then cut 14 inches out of what was left from the going backwards. And then they put it back together and welded it back together, and then put the fiberglass body on it. I bought it like that. And I used to take that engine out. It had four bolts that held it to the transaxle, and then the throttle cable and the gas line and a couple of heater hoses. And I'd put my arms up underneath the cylinders, two cylinders going out in opposite directions on either side. Put my arms under that while I'm sitting down and just pull it back off the transaxle and the engine fall right in my lap. Then I'd stand up with it, take it in the house, set it down on the workbench in my bedroom, and tear it apart. Fix whatever was broken in it, put it all back together, take it back there. My dad said he thought I had a zipper on that thing, on the engine, because one day he'd come home and they'd be sitting there with no engine in it. Next day he'd come home, it was out on the road running around. I had a good time with that. Learned a lot on that dune buggy.
We had that. But yeah, they have contests to see how fast people can pull an engine out of a Volkswagen. And, it, you know, with air tools and and all. I don't know how what they've gotten it down to, but it's just a real short period of time. I think it's just they measure it in seconds, and so yeah, I've never pulled one, but I've heard that they're easy to pull out, and pull a lot of transmissions out that way. Yank the bolts out of them, and you know, of course, you have the drive shaft already off, and unplug the sensors and the speedometer cable, and just slide it right out, and just hold it there in your hand. And of course, a lot of them now you can't do that; they're just too dang heavy. But anyway, well, let me run. I'm gonna go inside, and my wife's already come out at the garage to see what I'm doing in my car.
All right, David. Well, that's just good timing. I was thinking about asking you how you got into that and trying to do the math in my head when you keyed up the radio. So, good talking to you. I enjoyed it. Until next time. KB4CVA, W4DJ, WClear.
Good night, and we'll talk to you later, David. I enjoyed it. W4DJW, KB4CBA.